Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Wong Kar-wai, the poet of longing. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 14 minutes. You're listening to Filmmaking Giants. Today we're stepping into the work of a director who doesn't just tell stories about love and memory, he builds films that feel like remembering. Wong Kar-wai is often described as the poet of longing, but that phrase can sound like a compliment you put on a poster. What it really means is that his cinema doesn't behave like normal narrative cinema. It behaves like desire. It repeats, it delays, it circles, it fixates on details, it turns time elastic, it makes the ordinary feel sacred, and it leaves you with the ache of something that was almost possible. Wong's films are about people who live beside their own lives. People who sense that a door opened and they didn't step through it in time. People who perform normality while carrying a secret interior, whether regret, yearning, loneliness, and the strange comfort of routine. His genius is that he doesn't present longing as melodrama. He presents it as atmosphere. You don't just watch his characters want something, you inhabit the space where wanting becomes a way of living. To understand Wong Kar-wai, you have to understand that his primary subject is time, not time as chronology but time as feeling. Most films treat time as a track. Scenes follow each other, events cause other events, and the narrative moves forward like a train. Wong treats time like perfume. It lingers. It returns. It catches in your throat. His films aren't structured around what happens. They're structured around what remains. That's why his movies feel so dense with repetition. A hallway you see again and again. A stairwell that becomes a private universe. A song that returns like an obsession. A gesture repeated until it stops being incidental and becomes fate. In Wong's world, repetition isn't redundancy. It's devotion. It's how memory works. It's how longing works. You replay a moment because you can't change it. You replay it because the replay is all you have left. And his most famous film, In the Mood for Love, is not simply a romance. It's a film about restraint as a form of romance, and about restraint as a form of tragedy. Two people discover that their spouses are unfaithful with each other. They are drawn together by shared injury and shared curiosity. How did it happen? What did it look like? What did it feel like? But they also carry a code, an idea of decency, an idea of not becoming the thing that wounded them. They keep telling themselves, "We won't be like them." And that vow becomes both their moral anchor and their prison. The astonishing thing about In the Mood for Love is that it isn't driven by consummation. In a lesser film, the tension would build toward a confession, an affair, an explosion. Wong does something more painful. He builds a love story out of what is not done. The film is full of thresholds, doorways, hallways, corners, places where something could happen and doesn't. It's full of almost touching. Full of proximity that never becomes permission. The audience feels the love precisely because the love is held back. Wong understands that longing grows in the space between desire and action. If you remove that space, you remove the ache. Wong's camera is essential to this. He frames his characters through barriers, door frames, windows, mirrors, curtains, narrow hallways. Even when two people are in the same room, the framing often makes them feel separated, as if they exist in parallel. He shoots them partially obscured, cropped, interrupted by architecture. This doesn't just look beautiful. It tells you the truth of their lives. They are always watched, always contained by social space, always interrupted by the world. Privacy is rare. And when privacy arrives, it doesn't guarantee freedom. It can intensify what they can't have. Then there's the color. Wong Kar-wai's films are famous for color, but again, it isn't decoration. Color is emotional temperature. In the Mood for Love, the reds and greens, the deep shadows, the warm light, make the world feel like it's always on the edge of heat, passion held behind a closed door. The costumes become part of the emotional architecture. The dresses are not just wardrobe. They are repetition, ritual, time passing through pattern. The characters become almost like moving memories inside the frame. And then there's the music. Wong uses music the way memory uses music. A song doesn't simply score a moment, it becomes the moment. It becomes the trigger that brings the feeling back. He returns to the same cues, sometimes obsessively, and it works because longing is obsessive. When you're haunted by a person or a time, your mind doesn't create new experiences. It replays old ones. Wong builds his films out of replays. The result is a cinema where the plot can be described quickly, too quickly, but the experience cannot. You can summarize In the Mood for Love in a few sentences, and you will have explained almost nothing. That's because the film is not about the story. It's about the texture of waiting. The sensation of walking down a hallway knowing someone might be there. The sound of footsteps. The pause before a knock. The way the air changes when two people are in a room and both are pretending they don't feel what they feel. This approach to cinema didn't come from nowhere. Wong Kar-wai emerged from Hong Kong cinema, but he became something else entirely. He took the energy of Hong Kong, its speed, its density, its nocturnal life, its sense of people moving through compressed spaces, and transformed it into a lyric language. Hong Kong in his films is not just a city, it's a condition. It's a place where people brush past each other, where anonymity and intimacy coexist, where time feels accelerated and yet emotionally stuck. In Chungking Express, you can see Wong's playful side, his ability to turn loneliness into something buoyant, even comedic, without making it shallow. The film is built out of two stories that circle around breakups and chance encounters. It's full of pop energy, fast images, sudden shifts, music that feels like a heartbeat. But beneath the surface is the same Wong preoccupation. People dealing with the absence of someone. People trying to create rituals to survive loss. A character buys canned pineapple with an expiration date because he wants his grief to have a deadline. That's funny, yes, but it's also devastatingly human. We all try to give our pain a structure. We try to convince ourselves time can be negotiated. Wong also understands that cities produce a particular kind of loneliness. Loneliness in crowds. In his films, people are surrounded by motion, neon, traffic, voices, music, and yet they remain isolated, sealed inside their own interior monologues. The city becomes a metaphor for emotional life. Endless proximity without connection, constant contact without intimacy, thousands of lives passing close enough to touch, and yet missing each other by inches. That's why his style, his famous use of step printing, his blurred motion, his slowed down moments, feels so right. It's not a trick. It's a way of representing how time feels when you are lonely or in love. Some moments speed past, chaotic, indistinct. Other moments slow down so much they become heavy. Wong visualizes that inner time. He shows you what it feels like to be trapped in memory while life continues moving around you. Then there's Happy Together, which takes his themes into the territory of rupture and migration. Two men travel to Argentina and their relationship breaks and reforms in cycles that feel both inevitable and exhausting. The film is about love as pattern. About how people can hurt each other and still be drawn back. About the way a relationship can become a home even when it is destructive. Wong films desire here not as elegance but as need. The longing isn't refined. It's raw. And the foreign setting intensifies the emotional isolation. You can be far from everything familiar and still find that the thing you can't escape is yourself. Wong's characters often try to reinvent themselves. They move to new places, change routines, adopt new personas. But Wong understands that reinvention doesn't erase longing. It carries it. Sometimes reinvention is just a new way of hiding the same ache. And perhaps no film captures Wong's obsession with memory and future loss like 2046. It's a film that is, in many ways, the ghost of In the Mood for Love. It circles the same emotional territory but with a different posture. More cynical, more fragmented, more haunted. 2046 is about a man who turns longing into narrative, who writes, who seduces, who repeats patterns, who tries to outrun feeling by transforming it into style. The title itself suggests a date, a room, a year, an idea of a place where nothing changes. It's about the fantasy that there is somewhere you can go to preserve what you lost. But the tragedy is that preservation is impossible. Even memory changes when you revisit it. This is where Wong becomes not just a stylist but a moral filmmaker. His films are beautiful, yes. But the beauty is not merely aesthetic pleasure. The beauty is part of the pain. Because beauty can be a trap. The more beautiful the memory, the harder it is to let go. The more perfect the imagined version of what could have been, the more the present feels like failure. Wong's cinema is full of imagined futures. People fantasizing about what might happen. People rehearsing conversations. People playing out scenarios. In the Mood for Love, the characters role-play their spouse's affair, trying to understand it, trying to map it. That role play becomes a way of getting close without admitting they want closeness. Wong is brilliant at showing how people use performance to hide truth from themselves. They act out the thing they can't say. They pretend it's only practice. But practice becomes reality. Or at least it becomes emotional reality. This is why Wong is so influential. Because so many modern filmmakers want to capture mood and longing, want to make romance that isn't sentimental, want to make memory feel alive. But what many imitators miss is that Wong's style is not separate from his emotional insight. The neon and the slow motion and the pop songs are not cool for the sake of cool. They are the language of the character's inner states. Remove the inner truth and the style becomes empty imitation. Wong's greatest craft lesson might be this. Meaning can be built from repetition and detail. A hand carrying noodles down a hallway. A cigarette lit in silence. A glance held half a second too long. A song that returns. A clock. A narrow corridor. The ritual of passing each other in a stairwell. These details become the story because they become the evidence of a life. And he also teaches that romance doesn't require grand declarations. In fact, sometimes grand declarations destroy romance. Wong's romances often live in what isn't spoken, in what is implied, in what is deferred. That deferral is not cowardice in his films. It's often a form of survival. People don't act because action has consequences. They don't speak because speech changes reality. They hold back because holding back preserves a fragile world where longing can exist without becoming ruin. But Wong is not romanticizing restraint as virtue. He shows its cost. He shows the tragedy of two people who might have been happy, who might have built a life together, but who were shaped by their era, by social expectations, by fear, by loyalty to an idea of decency that also happens to be a cage. In that sense, In the Mood for Love is not only about two individuals. It's about a society. It's about the way social structure determines what kinds of love are allowed. And he never lets you forget time. Time is the real antagonist in Wong Kar-wai's cinema. Time makes love late. Time makes opportunity brief. Time turns passion into memory. Time turns memory into myth. Time makes people become strangers. Time makes you look back and realize you missed the moment when your life could have been different. There is a famous feeling that Wong captures better than almost anyone, the feeling of recognizing a turning point only after it has passed. You don't know it was the last time until it's gone. You don't know it was the beginning until it's already ending. Wong's films are built out of that ache. They are built out of the recognition that life is always slipping forward while we live emotionally backward, replaying, revisiting, longing. And yet, despite all this melancholy, Wong's films are not nihilistic. There is warmth in them. There is humor. There is the simple fact that longing itself is evidence that something mattered. The pain is not proof of failure, it is proof of depth. Wong seems to understand that to be human is to be haunted by what you love, and that the haunting is not only curse. It is also a form of meaning. So when we call Wong Kar-wai the poet of longing, what we really mean is that he found a cinematic language for the interior life, especially the interior life that is shaped by absence. He made films where love is not simply an event, but a climate. Where memory is not an explanation, but a texture. Where time is not a neutral passage, but a force that sculpts the heart. You've been listening to Filmmaking Giants. Today we explored Wong Kar-wai, color, gesture, repetition, and the lost future inside his frames. In the next episode, we'll turn to Alfonso Cuarón, the fluid camera, where motion becomes intimacy, and spectacle becomes a way of placing you inside a moral situation rather than simply impressing you from a distance.